know that we jumped from a message series about Jonah into a message series about the afterlife called The After Party. And I was really surprised at the response that I have received about these messages. And as I mentioned last week, I'm also really surprised and profoundly grateful that God had prepared me for this week by working on this series, having lost two family members in a week and had a funeral, doing a funeral for Catherine Tidd this past Friday. It was very reassuring and very helpful for me to do this. So many of you have heard, originally I was going to do a series that was going to begin with just what is there an afterlife, and then we'd have a good one on hell, you know, and then we'd have a good one on heaven. Well, if you can have a good sermon on hell. But something began to change, and I realized that as I was moving into the series, you know, we could probably combine the two sermons together on heaven and hell, because there's something more important, or something also important, that we need to hear about. That's the apocalypse. Well, yeah, really, in a way. But I will call it, if you notice the sermon title, the new creation. So it's something indeed that seems to rivet the entire nation. For years there have been, maybe even centuries, there have been books written about, you know, all these cataclysmic events that could happen. And our society seems to be focused on what society views as apocalyptic events. Someone has actually done a study that says that in the era of modern film, there have been 250 movies written about around an apocalyptic theme, and that in the last decade, in the last two decades, they have the number of films like that have doubled each and every time. So much so that in the last decade, I guess the 90s to the 2000s perhaps, or 2000 to 2010, there were 100 movies produced about that. Some of you kind of remember. Maybe your first encounter was back in the 80s when this TV show came out called The Day After, 1983, The Day After. I don't remember it. I was a teenager then. Maybe I didn't watch it. But people were riveted to their TVs as they watched this show that talked about the nuclear holocaust and how what would happen in this little town in Kansas and how all that went. It was a very apparently dark and depressing thing. Then you can jump a couple of decades, and coming up into the 90s, we had Deep Impact, Bruce Willis. Remember that one? Comet on Collision Course the Earth. Then we had I Am Legend in the 2000s, Will Smith, you know, trying to solve, you know. And now, TV shows. TV shows like one that I actually can watch and was trying to hang in with, Falling Skies, Alien Invasion, and how people kind of dealt with the new society that was emerging. And then, of course, the one I cannot watch, my family loves it, and I can't usually make 5 minutes, but The Walking Dead. I'm sorry. And I will, if you want to talk about that, we'll talk about it later, not here. But there's this fascination, not only with life after death, but the end of times. What is it? What is the end point of human history, not just our individual destiny as humans? Of course, I don't know where you were. I can remember that where I was on the day of the Mayan apocalypse. Remember December 21st, 2012? You know, there was a truck in Portsmouth where I lived at the time and where I served, a truck in Portsmouth that rode up and down the streets, a big box truck with letters on the side. The day is coming, and the date, like 12/21/2012. Nothing happened. Sometimes when things do happen, you remember where you were when you heard about it or when it happened. That's a no-show. That didn't happen. Because perhaps the word apocalypse isn't what society says it is. Apocalypse, in the Greek, literally says apocalypse. I mean, we just borrowed that. Means an unveiling or a revealing. And in the Latin, it's revelatio. I see some, the book of Revelation, John on the island of Patmos having this weird and almost science fiction dream of God telling what the future was to hold with all of humanity. And John had a revelation from God, an unveiling of some future event. The apocalypse isn't necessarily all these bad things. Bombs and nuclear waste and zombies. That's not the apocalypse. The apocalypse is God revealing the new creation. When we look at the book of Revelation, it's not so much about, okay, yeah, there's some of those things that happened to those bad seven churches and those bad areas. But in the end, chapter 21, God reveals His plan for all eternity. He calls it the new creation. In our scripture today, the end of the world, as it turns out, is not the end, but a rebirth of the whole creation. You know, from John chapter 3, where we get Jesus and Nicodemus having that famous discussion about life and rebirth. He says to Nicodemus, "Truly, truly, I say to you that unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." So we who follow Jesus, we who are Christians, at that moment that we believe and turn our lives over to Jesus, then we become born again into a new life and into the life to come. Similarly, John talks in Revelation about a new creation that God has shown him of this world, of this universe, if you will. So it goes beyond us and our new creations. I'm a new creation. Anne's a new creation. You're a new creation. Frank's a new creation. We're all new creations when we trust and believe on Jesus. But there's the other part of creation. There's societal creation. There's the creation that involves society and the environment and all the things and material things on this earth. And it's going to be made new. Verse 1 that you just heard Francis read says, "And then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more." Now, I can't tell you what John saw. I've only got these words. And everything past chapter 3 is full of figurative, not literal, but very figurative symbols. But what we see here, the gist of it is the world as we have it, full of fire and cyclones, floods, fires out west, full of drugs and crime and cancer, is passed away. That world is no more. And there's this new heaven and a new earth. And for some reason it says the sea has passed away. And if you figure that out, please come see me after the service, John or Chuck or somebody. But what that tells me is that world is going to be so much different. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe we don't need a drink of water or orange juice or whatever. I don't know. But the important point is it's a new heaven and a new earth. Verse 5 backs that up again where he says, "And he who was seated on the throne said, 'Behold, I am making all things new.'" God is making the church new when Jesus comes back. God is making our in-process new creation, human being self-souls, spirits new in a most perfect and holy way. God is making the grass new. God's making weather patterns new. God is making the bricks and the mortar of this church new. He's making all things new when that day comes. What is so beautiful about this is John isn't quite so focused on grass and bricks and mortar. But what he says is the very locus, the focus, the central part of this new creation is our relationship with God. He says his focus is on that holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down from the heavens. In the old Jerusalem, as we know from our Old Testament history, that is where God was located. That is where the people of Israel would journey to, hopefully make a pilgrimage at least once in their life to come to Jerusalem where God was located. Just like the tabernacle that moved throughout the desert was God's dwelling place, so was the temple built by Solomon in Jerusalem, a temple that was destroyed, a temple that Isaiah in Isaiah 65 said would be rebuilt and God would wipe away every tear from every eye. And we pick that up when we hear what John's reaching back to Isaiah and picking that up, saying it's really going to happen in this new Jerusalem. It's not something built by man where God dwells, but it's built by God, and God comes to dwell with us. His favorite, most cherished, most beloved creation. Humankind, made in the image of God. You're made in the image of God. And though we kind of mar that a whole lot with our sinful behavior and patterns and attitudes and thoughts, when that day comes, you being created in the image of God will reach your perfection. And you will be the perfect you. He says, behold, about this new Jerusalem. Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them. They will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. We don't have to wait anymore to travel. We know that we don't have to just come here to be with God, right? You know that God is with you. But at that time, God will be with his people. Paul says something in his writings about now we see as though through a mirror dimly, or through a looking glass dimly, but then we will see as face to face. Our relationship with God is like looking through, well, it worked better in the chapel this morning, but you know those fuzzy windows, you know, those kind of tinted windows with the swirls in them over there. We could see. I could usually tell during a meeting if we're in the library. I can tell if somebody comes in the parking lot, but I don't know who it is. I can't tell. But when the new creation comes, or when we have crossed from death into eternal life, we will be as one, face to face. The glass is clear. The relationship is perfect. Not just with God, but with those who are also a part of the new creation. Now, of course, this is a perfect new creation. And we see evidence here of John saying, remember the Garden of Eden? You remember that? Garden of Eden. God was in the garden with Adam and Eve, and they were in perfect harmony and relationship. But when they had failed God, when they had disobeyed, when that time came and he cast them out of the garden, what happened then? Then death entered humanity. They had to deal with their eventual death. They had to deal with pain from childbirth, pain from working with blood, sweat, and tears to raise the crops from the ground, pain from the serpent biting their ankles and fighting with the serpent, and the agony and crying, not only of the pain, but of losing someone to death. John reaches back to Isaiah and says, and in this new Jerusalem, there will be no more death. There will be no more mourning and no more crying. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. That, my friends, is a beautiful picture. I don't care if the streets are paved with gold. I don't care if there's jewels everywhere. But to have that kind of an image to hold on to keeps me going through everything of life. Of course, John then has to make sure that we understand the other side of the equation. And he says, so for those who come to light, yes, we have this wonderful new creation in New Jerusalem, but for those who don't come to the light, those who prefer to hide in the darkness, to surround themselves with their own sinfulness and never let the light of Christ pierce that darkness, well, they experience what John calls in this vision a second death. And I'm sure, as we mentioned last week, that involves a total separation from God. Something I cannot fathom and would never wish upon anyone and wouldn't want for myself. Okay, so if this new creation's coming, and we know that and we believe that, not only personally, but as the whole universe, what are we to do with that? What is our Christian responsibility? as believers in Jesus Christ, what are we to do with society? What is our place in that? What is our place in the environment? What is our place in ethics? What are we to do? Well, now, we could act like spoiled children, couldn't we? We could say, hey, I'll just keep making mess after mess after mess for my own good and my own pleasure, and I know that who cares? Sometime in the future, God's going to come and clean up all those messes. There are Christians who believe that. And they consume and they consume and they make messes of relationships and they make messes of all the things that God has given them, their possessions, material wealth, the environment. Kind of a rape and pillage type of thing. We could, you know, that kind of, that reminds me of, if you can think way back to the movie, since we're talking about movies, Caddyshack. You remember the groundskeeper, Bill Murray? I can't remember his name, but he was in charge of keeping the grounds of the country club. And he was so fixated on getting rid of that one rodent, that one groundhog, he ended up blowing the whole place up. Do we want to be like that? Is that a good Christian response? Or is it more like Lou Thomas, who many of you know? Lou Thomas, who creates week after week these beautiful arrangements, who can grow anything out of anything, who sees everything as something to be nurtured and grown, whether it be a plant, a person, an animal. When I visited her last year as the new pastor here, she was in the hospital. What was it, hip surgery, I think? Knee surgery. But when I visited her, her daughter Catherine was there, and we were talking, and she was doing really well, and she wanted to give Catherine something, so she opened her pocketbook and says, oh my goodness, look at this. I said, what is that? It was a limp piece of a plant, just dangling. Oh, 2 days ago I was at Lowe's, and it was on the ground, and I knew I could get it. Catherine, take this home, put it in some rooting medium, and set it over here, and do this, that, and the other, and by the time I get home, I'll make it grow. I'm sure she did. Caddyshack or Lou Thomas? Which response is God calling us to be? What would it look like? How could we respond to be more like Lou? Well, the easy answer is, you know, we're called to be Christian stewards of everything that we have. God has given us literally everything. God's given you and me the whole environment on this earth and the atmosphere above it. He's given us our own bodies and our own state of health, wherever that is right now. He's given us money and material things, and He's given us relationships with others, including relations that extend into society beyond our family and friends. He's given us the ability to make ethical, wise decisions. And I think that one of the most distinctive parts about good old Methodist theology and doctrine is a deep rootedness in the image of God and in the new creation. That's been with us from the very beginning. Because Wesley had this kind of understanding of new creation, we're going to do a little Methodist history now. Because of that, we can learn so much from him and the early Christians, or the early Methodists. For instance, with the environment, there's not much said about that back then, but think, this is the industrial age. This is when all in England, all the coal-fired plants were starting up, and there was just soot and smoke and just, you know, waste in the streets and cholera and the plague and all that kind of stuff. And he actually, in addition to his religious reading, he read the sciences and produced a little readable book that everybody could read, and it focused on the interrelationships between the flora and the fauna of this world and how interconnected like a web all these things are and how important it was to take care of those things. For those of you in this room who I know are really strong on animal rights, he actually wrote about and took a stance against dog fights and cock fights and bull baiting, whatever that is. Somebody can educate me on bull baiting, I'm sure. But beyond the environment, he had a great, great impact and a great stance, and the people called Methodists also on human rights. I mean, there is a social implication to this new creation thing Early in his ministry, in about the first third of his ministry as a clergy person, he was feeling like he wasn't cut out to be a preacher. And John and his brother Charles Wesley, they got on a ship and they went over to Savannah, Georgia from England to become missionaries. They're going to convert all those heathen prisoners in Savannah and all those heathen Indians to Jesus. They failed miserably at that too. But while he was here in America, in North America, and he witnessed over and over again the horrors of a slave auction. And he writes how he had seen entire families being torn apart by the bidding of the slave owners, and how that was so wrong, not only to put someone as a piece of property under the rule of another, to tear apart those families. He became a very staunch advocate against slavery and was a partner, if you will, with William Wilberforce, the one who actually got it passed through the British Parliament. And it didn't pass till William died, but he got it through. Then there's the bad working conditions for all the people. Little shops, like some of these great little plays and books you've read, kids working in shops underage when they should be going to school, adults working for hardly any wage in dangerous working environments, and labor unions sprung up in England, and many of the leaders were Methodist lay preachers. They had the speaking skills, they had the organizational skills, they had the ability to kind of get people together, and they were the ones who said, out of their Christian response, we need better working environment for our people. I love this one. John Wesley had a great heart for the poor. He said, one of the reasons the wealthy have such a disregard for the poor is they never spend time with them. He went every week and not only visited in the debtor's prison, not only did the Methodist societies all collect a penny from everybody every time they met and then forwarded that to those who distributed it to the debtors so they could get out of prison and once again have a job and be with their family and live a life. But he spent time working in the poorest sections of the town, of the city, interacting with and rubbing shoulders with those that everybody else says were lazy and would not work. And he said, never when I visit the poor do I find anyone who's really unemployed. And he began to look at unemployment and figure out, why is this the case? This is really interesting to me. I don't know about you, but he says, one of the reasons why there's so much unemployment in England at that time was because food had gotten tremendously inflated in price over the past several years, maybe a decade. Why is that? Well, so many people spent all their money on food, the family had nothing left to buy material goods that were produced in the factories, and the factories started laying everybody off. They had widespread unemployment. Well, why is food so expensive? He wondered. So he did a little research on that, and he found out that the cost of bread had skyrocketed. Why? Because wheat was now being sold. Half of the wheat that was being sold at that time went to the distilleries and not to bread. And the price went up. Of course, he was starting to ramp up for prohibition in England at that time. But then he says, why is it so expensive? It can't just be wheat. He found that oats had also risen greatly in value. Why was that? Well, you see, back then, to be a good, upstanding gentleman, you must have more than one carriage pulled by a different team of horses. So if you had two or three or four carriages pulled by a different team of horses, you were quite the man of the town. And horses needed oats. And so the oats went to the horses for the wealthy to show off their wealth. And then he says, but that can't be all. How come there's not as much beef and mutton? Why is it so expensive to get meat? Because those who used to grow the vegetables and the grains realized there was great profit as gentlemen farmers in raising horses for the rich people. So they were raising horses instead of the food to supply the needs of the common people. Eventually, he said, if we can find them work, they will find meat. So he was all about the big picture, getting people back on the job. And he used political action. He did call for prohibition of hard spirits, those things which deprive and deprave, da-da-da-da-da. The people called Methodists and the people of London. He even called for levying taxes on any additional carriages you owned and additional teams of horses. He did these things. He used what he had and made changes. The people called Methodists actually began to quit spending all their money on gin, because that was a big deal back then, was gin, and began to actually save and put money aside and be in a position to help others. So as we look back on this little history lesson, as we look back on the fact that God has given each of us so much, my question to you, something to think and especially to pray about is, God, hey God, please help me see where I've been a great steward of whatever it is I have. Let me see it and let me appreciate it. Let me know that you appreciate it, God. Let me know that you're pleased. Because you see, a good steward, according to Wesley, a good steward was one who was not going to use what he had a hold of to please himself, but to please the one who entrusted him with it. So God, where am I pleasing you with the things that I've got? And God, when you show me that, show me an area or a thing or a resource where I could please you greater, where I could use more wisely and be a good steward. You've got relationships. How are you stewarding your relationships? You've got connections and friendships in this community. You've got gifts and skills for dealing with all that, ranging from music all the way down to working with children or art, finance. You've got the material possessions and the money God has given you. I think it really comes down to the relationships. For when we steward our relationship with God and each other, all those around us, something happens. All those pieces fall into place. Would you pray that for me? Would you pray that God, show me where I'm strong and where I need help? And when you conclude the prayer, say, God, I know I cannot do it by myself. I want you to help me to live a life that pleases you. God be the glory. Amen.